Let's call this meeting of Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:31 p.m. on Tuesday, February 18th. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum. Present today are Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Wilson, Senator Costello, Senator Kawasaki, and myself, Chairman Rivak. I'd like to also recognize Senator Machicki. Please silence your cell phones. Staffing the committee today are the amazing Carrie Cooper Ryder from Senate Records, Brett Mello as our moderator, and Ms. Betty Tangeman, my committee aide. Today we have three items on the agenda. The first two bills are sponsored by Senator Machicki, SB 137 to extend the Board of Parole, and SB 177, driving without a license penalty. The third is HB 109, Military Children's School Residency Waiver, which is sponsored by Representative Ledoux. And we plan to hear these bills and take public testimony, and we'll see how far we get today. So let's get started right away with SB 137. And in order to keep things moving along with this bill, I'd like to, if we could, have the committee hold the questions until after we hear from the invited testifiers, unless you have an absolute burning desire. I'd like to invite Senator Machicki and his legislative staff, Michael Willis, to come forward and please put yourself on the record and introduce the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for having us today. My name is Senator Peter Machicki from District O.
Good afternoon, Chair. My name is Michael Willis. I'm an intern for the Senator.
And this is Mr. Chairman, this is Michael's first bill. He's done an incredible job on this bill. So if I can do a brief introduction, and I'll hand it off to Michael. I'm not really a extending the termination date sort of guy, but I do recognize the importance of the Board of Parole, and I did not see anyone moving forward in this important extension. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Michael, and I'll take it from there.
Good afternoon. So SB 137 extends the Board of Parole termination date from June 30th, 2020 up to June 30th of 2025. Upon review of the recent legislative audit summary and the full audit report of the Alaska Board of Parole, it becomes apparent that in the opinion of our auditors, the Board of Parole is serving the public's interest by effectively evaluating prisoners' likelihood of recidivism and whether a prisoner poses a threat to the public. The Board of Parole serves an important role in guarding the safety of Alaskans by protecting the general public by determining whether parole-eligible prisoners are able to become functioning members of society. The significance of the board has increased since the passage of HB 49 in 2019. There's been an increase in the number of parole applicants because all eligible prisoners are given a hearing regardless of their desire. The situation has strained the Board of Parole, and it has also revealed our state's reliance on the work of the board. Auditors recommend that the legislature extend the board's termination date 5 years, 3 years less than the 8-year maximum allowed by statute. The reduced extension allows for review of recent changes to the board's statutes, impacts, and responsibility revisions related to HB 49, and the need for continued oversight. Chris Curtis, the legislative audit responsible for reviewing the Board of Parole, is here to provide her perspective on the matter, and the director of the Board of Parole, Jeffrey Edwards, is present telephonically to show support and answer any questions. Thank you for your support.
Well done. Thank you, sir. And Senator Machicki, appreciate that. Unless we have burning desires, maybe we could have invited testimony. So everybody good with that? All right, thank you so much. I'd like to invite Ms. Chris Curtis to come forward. Please put yourself on the record and walk us through the results of your audit, if you could, please.
Good Good afternoon. My name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. Division of Legislative Audit did conduct a sunset audit of the Border Parole. It is dated May 8th of 2019. That is the last date of our field work. That means that any changes to the parole statutes or over statutes governing the board after that date are not included as part of this audit. Just as a reminder, the purpose of a sunset audit is to determine whether a border commission is serving the public's interest and whether it should be extended. I'd like to start off by having you turn to page 2. This is a schedule of expenditures and funding sources for the board. You all have a copy of the audit? Okay. Expenditures were primarily for this board for personal services, travel, and for office rental costs. The schedule shows a large increase in expenditures beginning in FY17. This reflects the increase in the board's workload as a result of Senate Bill 91. And this bill became effective, these changes became effective in January 2017. 5 new positions were authorized to address the increase in workload. The audit does have a background information section beginning on page 5. The first few pages of the background information section provide a basic understanding of parole. I want to draw your attention to the bottom of page 8, where we explain we explain how SB 91 changed parole and how the changes impacted the Border Parole's workload and procedures. Senate Bill 91 significantly changed the board statutes effective January 2017. First, it expanded discretionary parole for all offenders except unclassified or Class A sex offenders. Prior to SB 91, offenders who committed their first Class B felony or up to their second Class C felony were eligible for discretionary parole after serving 25% of their sentences. Post-SB 91, generally, offenders who committed any number of A, B, or C felonies were eligible for discretionary parole after serving a quarter of their sentences. Secondly, SB 91 removed the discretionary parole application requirement. Prior to SB 91, prisoners initiated the parole process by submitting an application for parole, and not all eligible prisoners submitted applications. SB 91 removed the application requirement from state law, which changed how the board approached discretionary parole hearings. And thirdly, SB 91 shortened the technical revocation hearing timeline. Moving on to report conclusions beginning on page 11. The audit concluded that the board responded in an effective and efficient manner to significant changes in parole laws. During the audit period, the board conducted meetings, made parole decisions, set parole conditions, and held revocation hearings in accordance with state law. We recommend the legislature extend this board 5 years, and that is 3 years less than the 8-year maximum allowed for in statute. The reduced extension is mainly an acknowledgement of the recent changes to the board statutes, as well as anticipated changes to the board at the time we wrote the audit, and the need for continued oversight. The report contains several tables that help describe the board's activities during the audit period. If you turn to page 12, you'll see Exhibit 5. As discussed in background information section, SB 91 changed the eligibility standards and removed the application process for discretionary parole, which caused a significant increase in discretionary parole hearings in 2017 and 2018. The increase in discretionary parole hearings, as shown in Exhibit 5, included a significant number of hearings that prisoners did not attend, and we refer to those as no-shows. No-shows were the result of SB 91 eliminating the discretionary parole application requirement and mandating that hearings be held for all eligible prisoners, regardless of whether a prisoner wanted parole. According to the board's executive director, prisoners may not want discretionary parole for various reasons, including not willing to sign parole conditions or wanting to leave the facility without any conditions. Initially, parole officers and the board compiled parole packets and held discretionary hearings for no-shows in the same manner that they held them for prisoners who attended the hearings. This was not an effective use of resources, given that parole is not granted if a prisoner does not attend the hearing. The board recognized this inefficiency, and they changed their procedures in November 2017. The new procedures require institutional parole officers to complete condensed parole packets, and the board holds abbreviated hearings. As shown in Exhibit 6, no-shows represented 21% of discretionary parole hearings held in 2017 and 29% in 2018. According to the board staff, the increase in discretionary parole hearings led to increases in revocation hearings in 2017. This increase in workload, and this is on page 14 now, Exhibit 7. The increase in workload was partially in 2017 was partially offset in 2018 with through the use of an administrative sanction incentive program that allowed probation officers to impose sanctions without hearings for most of the most common technical violations based on a decision-making guide created by the Department of Corrections Management. The board effectively coped with the increase in their workload by traveling to each correctional facility four times a year instead of two times. The board also hired five new staff positions. We do have four recommendations for improvements, and they begin on page 18. None of these recommendations were significant enough to cause us to reduce the recommended term of extension. The reduced extension is solely in recognition that the board statutes continue to significantly change, and I believe it's prudent to increase oversight during this period. Recommendation number one, we recommend the board's executive director improve procedures to ensure final revocation hearings are performed timely. We found 16% of the revocation hearings we tested were not performed within 120 days of the parolee's arrest. The late hearings were between 5 and 12 days late. Recommendation number two, we recommend the board's executive director work with the Department of Corrections Commissioner to improve the quality of telephonic hearings. The audit identified poor quality telephone systems in 4 of 13 correctional facilities, including Yukon Kuskokwim, Wildwood, Fairbanks, and Highland Mountain. These facilities accounted for 14% of the parole and revocation hearings during calendar years 2015 through 2018. Recommendation number three, the board's executive director should take steps to ensure the regulations are properly updated. The audit identified two sections of regulations that were not properly updated due to human error. And then fourth recommendation on page 20, the Department of Corrections Division of Admin Services Director should take steps to ensure the Alaska Correctional Offender Management System complies with state information technology security standards and national best practices. We do not include the details of this finding in the report so the weaknesses are not exploited. We did communicate these findings to management in a separate confidential letter. As far as responses to the report, you will find those at the back of the audit report. The Department of Corrections Commissioner response is on page 33. The commissioner agrees that with the four findings and states that the department is moving forward with corrective action within the constraints of their budget. On page 35, the board chair concurs with all three recommendations that were directed to the board and what goes on to describe their planned corrective actions.
Thank you. Any committee questions at this point? Senator Kawasaki?
Thanks. Just briefly, thank you, Chris, for being here. Just a couple questions, and I'm just trying to figure out the timeline between 91, when that really changed over Board of Parole and responsibilities, and then 54 came, and then 49. And I don't even know if all the rulemaking and regulations have been propagated. Do you know that answer, and do you anticipate, because of this five-year audit sunset, that you're going to have to deal with that again in a future audit?
Through the chair, I know that after 91 was passed, there was immediately the next year changes to the parole. I know administrative parole was repealed, and that was part of the background information. I know that there were significant changes after May 2019 that this audit did not review.
Okay. Good enough. Thanks.
Right, thank you. I'd also like to note that we have Daniel Morse from the Auditor for Legislative Audit available for questions, as well as Mr. Jeffrey Edwards, Director of the Board of Parole, on the phone. Any further questions? Senator Wilson.
Hey, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the person from the Department of Law is also available for our questions that's in the room. I think she's currently occupied.
Brief it is. All right, we're back on the record. Any further questions from committee members? All right, well, we thank you, Ms. Curtis, Mr. Edwards, thank you for joining us on the phone, and thank you, Senator Marchicki, and Mr. Willis for presenting this bill to us. We will open public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? There is no one online. All right, seeing none, thank you to all those who have already testified. We're going to close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. I'd like to encourage folks with written testimony to email to ssta@akleg.gov. For the record, there is a zero fiscal note attached to this bill. And we're going to hold this bill for further consideration. All right, up next, SB 177, driving without a license penalty. I'd like to invite Senator Marchicki back to the microphone with Mr. Willis. And please come and put yourselves on the record and introduce SB 177.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Senator Peter Marchicki, District O.
Thanks for having me, Chair. Michael Willis, intern for Senator Marchicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is about something we missed in HB 49, and that is when we returned the driving with a suspended and revoked license to a potential Class A misdemeanor. We skipped driving without a license, which has left a fairly significant gap for law enforcement when they identify someone who's driving without a license, which would encourage folks that may determine that a way of life as a criminal would be best served if you were to never obtain a license. It just kept it at a violation. So it's a simple cleanup bill, Mr. Chairman. There is, well, I'll let Michael present the bill if that's okay, and then we can come back. I have one issue I want to point out in the bill that for you all to investigate as you consider this bill.
Senate Bill 177, an act related to driving without a license, seeks to resolve an inconsistency by eliminating a loophole in state law that allows two drivers who have committed nearly identical crimes to receive vastly different penalties. Under current law, the severity of penalty for driving without a license is dependent upon whether the individual driving formerly possessed a license. If an individual operates a motor vehicle with a license that is canceled, suspended, revoked, or in violation of a limitation, they are potentially guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. However, an individual who operates a vehicle without ever having any prior licensure is only guilty of a traffic infraction. This discrepancy impedes the efforts of law enforcement, is unjust, and requires immediate reconciliation. Lieutenant Cornelius Simpf of the Alaska State Troopers, Chief Peter Milnerik of Soldotna PD, and Chief Dave Ross of Kenai PD are present telephonically to show support and answer any questions you may have. Casey Schroeder, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Law, is also present. Thank you for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Senator Marchicki.
Yeah, thank you. I think what you're going to hear, perhaps, and I've had some calls on this, and I'll let them discuss their concerns with Section 2. Since under the law we can't really separate 13-year-olds from adults on the way that it's considered, I think you'll find that they worry that Section 2, which is grounds for immediate revocation of a driver's license, privilege to drive, or privilege to obtain a license, could potentially impact a mischievous child in a way that would make their early years of driving significantly more expensive and have more of an impact than was the goal of this bill. The goal of this bill is to treat everyone else the same as a suspended or revoked license. However, in Section 2, you're actually penalizing them for already having a suspended or revoked license. When it comes to a child, I think you're going to find that they feel that this section, and only this section, perhaps goes a bit too far when you consider someone that may hop in their parents' car without permission at a young age and do something they shouldn't be doing, but perhaps shouldn't penalize them for years to come afterwards. So that's all I wanted to explain, Mr. Chairman. Unless you have questions, I'm here to answer what I can.
Well, did I understand? Are you interested in an amendment? Or am I understanding you wrong?
I would like for you to listen to the public testimony and perhaps the Department of Law, and I think together we can discuss if the right answer is to eliminate Section 2, amend out Section 2. But I'd like to hear how they feel about it first before I give you an answer that I'd like to see an amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Fair enough, Senator Machicki. Thank you. Thank you again, Mr. Willis. I'd like to note that Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law is present to answer questions, and we do have some invited testimony from Chief Peter Milnerick of the Soldotna Police Department on the line. I think we'll go right to Chief Milnerick. Sir, are you there? Could you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony?
Yeah, this is Chief Peter Milnerick from Soldotna Police Department. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I really appreciate Senator Machicki closing the gap on this driving without a license. He's right. It was something that was there before, and it was a misdemeanor prior to SB 91. And I like everything I read about it. Like you said, I just am a little concerned about that Section 2 with driving without a license for somebody that's young and doesn't have their head quite straight, and then causing a potential of having to get being revoked or privileged drive revoked, and then they would be required to get SR-22 insurance, which is really expensive. And so we're not trying to penalize them for that. And it looks like prior to SB 91, that was not in that section under Section 2A9, driving without a license, wasn't in the previous version, several years ago, 5 years ago or so. So, but the rest of the bill looks good.
Thank you, Chief. And I'm sorry, how did I say your name?
I'm not sure. It's a hard one. Milnerick is.
Milnerick. Okay. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from committee members? No. All right. We also have Lieutenant Ben Langman, Kenai Police Department, and Lieutenant Cornelius Sims of the Alaska State Troopers. Let's go to Lieutenant Sims. Are you there? Could you put yourself on the record and tell us your thoughts on this bill?
Yes, sir, I am. This is Lieutenant Sims with the Alaska State Troopers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to also thank Senator Machicki for the work he did, because this was a gap that we saw when the changes with 49 and going back to before 91, where it was a misdemeanor for driving without a license, and somewhere where it needs to be, we would be in support of seeing it get back to a misdemeanor. The concern I would have, is, as the chief pointed out, in that you get a minor, someone younger, not thinking clearly, decides to get behind the wheel. They don't have a driver's license. They get stopped. They get cited. found, you know, guilty of, you know, convicted of driving without a license, and then they get this automatic revocation or their privilege to give a driver's license is revoked, which then causes SR-22 a requirement for insurance and other financial things that for someone, you know, a minor to have that over them until they can potentially get a license is, or could get that clear up so they could get a license is, I think, something to be looked at for sure. Other than that, the bill I support.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Simpf. Any questions, committee questions? All right, well, we really appreciate it. I think we'll open up public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Would anybody in the room like to testify? Seeing none, I don't think we have any public testimony online. We're going to close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. I'd like to thank all the folks who testified. Thank you, Senator Marchicki and Mr. Wills, for presenting this bill. I would like to, I think we'll hold this bill, and I'd like to hear back from committee members, and maybe we can talk. And my intent, I think this is a good bill, and I'd like to see it get through. There's just a couple questions. Maybe we'll flesh that out a little bit and make sure this policy is good before we move it forward. And Senator Wilson.
Yeah, if we could just, I don't know if Ms. Schroeder could just, if she has comments upon Senator Marchicki's statements about Section 2, if the department has a position on that.
Yeah, Ms. Schroeder, please.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. The Department of Law is neutral on the bill, and whether or not Section 2 remains in the bill or is out of the bill is a policy question for the legislature. So we don't take a position on whether or not it's in or out. And I'm just here to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. I have a question maybe you'd be able to answer. On private property, such as farms and things, if somebody is underage, are they able to drive a vehicle for the purposes of the agricultural work they might have to do on farm? Do you happen to know?
Chair Rebeck, I would be guessing at this point. I would want to look that up and get back to the committee on that.
Okay. Okay, yeah, well, I appreciate any other questions. Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Since you're up there, I do have a couple questions. Just sort of this is a policy question about whether a person who's driving just without a license versus a person who's had their license revoked for some reason, right? And I guess my question is how different is the what are the penalties for an infraction or a moving violation versus what are the penalties of under a Class A misdemeanor? Like maximums, I guess. I'm more interested in that.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the penalty for an infraction is a fine up to $300. A Class A misdemeanor carries a term of imprisonment of up to 1 year. But I will point out for the committee that this bill has mandatory minimums associated with this particular Class A misdemeanor. So there's kind of three things going on there.
And then through the chair.
Yes.
And then I guess another byproduct of getting, so if a person now has a violation, a moving violation because they didn't have a driver's license, that would be just an infraction. If it moves up to the Class A misdemeanor, I heard that one of the penalties, one of the things that would happen to them is that after they do get a license, they would have to get SR-22 insurance. Is that correct? How does that work?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I'd have to defer to Lieutenant Sims on the insurance aspect of that. They're more familiar. I'm more familiar with the criminal sanctions for these crimes.
Thank you. Sure.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. We appreciate you. We're going to hold this bill. And thank you again, Ms. Senator Machicki and Mr. Wills. We'll get back to this at a future date. I'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record, and we are going to hear HB 109, the military and military children's school residency waiver. I'd like to invite Representative Ledoux and her staff member, Deneen Tuck, to please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Chair Rivak and members of the committee. My name is Gabrielle Ledoux, and I represent House District 15, which is Muldoon and the Elmendorf portion of J-Bare. And with me is my Chief of Staff, Deneen Tuck. And we are here to present House Bill 109, Military Children School Residency Waiver. And what this bill does, it allows military children with residency outside of the state to register in school districts throughout Alaska if their parents have documentation of a pending military relocation to the state. And this is important to military school children, especially those in high school, because sometimes by the time they actually get here, the classes are full. They need specific classes in order to complete their requirements. And it's also important to children or parents who want to enroll their children in charter schools, because those are done by lotteries, and they're done way before the school starts. And this bill would also give the parents 10 days after they have enrolled their, after they've reached here and the children have started school, in order to prove residency in the district. And it's, I hate to use the phrase, this is a relatively simple bill, because that's usually death to a bill, but it is a relatively simple bill. And we came upon this idea through the Department of Defense, which is trying to get bills such as this passed in all 50 states. So if there are any questions, I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. And I'd like to note that we also have Tammy Peralt from the Department of Defense in Tacoma, Washington, available for questions, as well as Heidi Teschner from the Department of Education in Juneau, available for questions. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you. It's good to see you here.
Good to be here.
Mr. Chair, my question would be, and it's really for the Anchorage School District, I'd be interested in knowing what the enrollment timeline is for the charter schools and the language immersion schools, and then how the Anchorage School District and all districts would address the first round of lottery. I mean, they would have to then contact the families out of state and ask if they choose to accept the lottery invitation, because oftentimes families will sign up for more than one charter school or one lottery. So, you know, I'd be curious to have the one of the larger school districts or maybe an education association weigh in on the bill next time you hear it.
Thank you, Senator Costello, and maybe maybe Heidi Teschner from the Department of Education could take a stab at that. Heidi, are you there? If you could, if you are, put yourself on the record and let us know your thoughts. If you heard that question.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. For the record, Heidi Teschner, Director of Finance and Support Services with the Department of Education and Early Development. And through the chair, Senator Costello, I don't know the specific timelines of when those lotteries and those applications have to be in specifically, but I'm happy to work with our charter school coordinator here to get back with the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Teschner. We would appreciate that. Follow-up?
Yes.
All right. We have a follow-up. Senator Costello?
Thank you. And just to clarify that there's a difference between the charter and the lottery. So we have lotteries in Anchorage, which are public schools, and just wanted to put that on the record, and I'm sure she's aware of that. But there's a timeline for that, and I would just be curious about the logistics of how you move families and students on and off these various wait lists when they're essentially, it's a process that the schools go through to try to figure out their incoming class. And that's just really my question about the logistics of how it would operate.
Thank you, Senator Costello. Senator Kawasaki?
Could I interject something here, perhaps as an answer to Senator Costello's question?
Go ahead, Representative Ledoux.
So I guess it wouldn't seem any more difficult to deal with the families who are out of state, either through telephone or through email, than it would be if they are down the block, really. I mean, you'd still have to go through the same sort of routine about contacting those families, telling them that they have prevailed in a lottery, and see where they want to go.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. And this bill requires that the military members have orders, and so by the time so that's something that quelled my concerns, were that their orders are very, very specific, and typically once they have orders, they don't change. Very rarely do the orders change. They kind of know where they're going and what and when. Just from my perspective, fantastic question. Senator Kawasaki?
Just a couple questions, and maybe Heidi can tell us a little bit. The Anchorage School District actually did put a letter in our packet dated May 14th about support for the bill. It doesn't mention specifically the charter or the lottery systems, but it looks like a letter of support. I don't know how they'd implement it either, so it would be cool to have the Anchorage School District come before us. The question, though, for Heidi is average daily membership numbers are calculated, and does this have an impact on that?
Ms. Teschner?
Yes, again, for the record, Heidi Teschner. So through the chair, there's a four-week count period that ends the fourth Friday in October, and so typically, hopefully by that time frame, military families have been moved and in the community, so it would be counted as part of that count period. I know that throughout the year, students will fluctuate and move between school districts. And so if a student is, say Anchorage got a military student that came in after the count period, but they lost another student to another district, or that this other student moved out of state, they would have gotten counted for a student at that point in time. So there could be fluctuations throughout the year in student count, but pretty much that seems to average out with the wins and losses throughout the year, according to what we're told from other districts. So, but in a nutshell, if they're in the count period during October, they would be counted towards the average daily membership that gets funded through the foundation program.
So through the chair.
Yes.
Okay, so this is probably not necessarily specifically for this bill, but so the ADM count that's in the fourth Friday in October is a hard date then, and that person has to be in their seat in the school district?
Through the chair, it's a membership, so they just have to be enrolled during that count period.
And so through the chair, would an enrollee under this section be considered enrolled in the school even though they physically are not here on the fourth Friday in October?
Through the chair, if their enrollment paperwork is on file with the district, they would be counted.
Through the chair, I'll just to Senator Coghill and I have a pretty large contingent coming up to Fairbanks at Eielson, and it's like right in a weird time. It's a little bit slower. We had 40 new kids come in, but they don't anticipate the newer kids to come in before that date next year, is what our school district thinks. And so that's why it's important for us to know how that would impact the ADM for the school district. So that was just my comment. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Are there any other questions from members of the committee? All right, I'd like to thank Tammy Peralt and Heidi Teschner and Representative Ledoux. I think, are we sure there's no more questions? Yes, Senator Coghill.
As far as the policy goes, I think it's a good policy call. A lot of the education questions are going to find their way into the education committee, mostly on the anchored, the daily membership and all the counting and all that. But I think it's pretty clear they'll be considered resident when they apply, and then 10 days after they get here, that solidifies it. So no matter when they show up, whether they're in the count or out of the count, I think that's going to be a clear thing. So if you get the orders and they don't, they mean you get here in February, then you can apply as soon as you get the orders, which I think is can be 6 months ahead, right? You can apply, but they'll just be considered a resident until you get here, and then you have to solidify it within 10 days. So unfortunately, whether we like it or not, the military goes on a 360-day clock that doesn't always fit our school decision. I get that. We'd like it to, but it just doesn't. So when we get to the education committee, it may percolate up the discussion on how do we have a true-up count throughout the year, because there are times where both villages and military have a huge impact on our schools. And it is true that oftentimes they average out, but in our case, the average is going to get blasted pretty hard. So it's something that we need to talk about, and I didn't intend to bring it up this time, but when we get to the education committee, that is something that I'll talk about.
Thank you, Senator Coghill, and that's a good point. This bill does still have a referral to Senate Education. Senator Costello?
Thank you. And I appreciate the intent of what this legislation is trying to do. I was just thinking that in terms of applying for a permanent fund dividend, how could a person be both a resident of an outside state and a current state? So what I just want to throw that out there in terms of we might want to look at, clarify that, because what we're saying here is for all intensive purposes with a local government school district, we're treating the individual as if they're a resident, and it says it right here. And my question would be how we address that with the dividend, because you can imagine that with the timing issue that a family might say, well, I was a resident, and there might be a question. So just throw that out there.
Thank you, Senator Costello. And so we had a similar concern, not just with all the other agencies in terms of what residency would look like. And so we asked and were informed that this would not impact any of the other agencies. But I mean, we could get somebody to come in front of the committee and testify, or we could do that in education, or a couple different options. But the language, I think, a school district shall consider a student to be a resident of the district. So I think that specific language is what made the difference. We're gonna Thank you very. Does anybody else have any questions? Of any other questions? No. We're going to take a brief at ease. Ms. Tuck, could you please put yourself on the record and talk to us a little bit about the residency piece in this bill?
Deneen Tuck, Chief of Staff for Representative Ledoux. And the permanent fund dividend residency portion of this would not affect this bill. The reason being is the permanent fund rules and regulations are specific as to when you have to be in town. So if they come in, like, say, August, September, or October, that's fine. But you have to be here from January 1st to December 31st of a calendar year before you are qualified for a PFD. So they can be here, say, they move in October of 2020. They have to be here 2021 from January to December before they're eligible for the 2022 permanent fund dividend. So the residency requirements from the permanent fund dividend office are you have to be here one full calendar year from a January 1st to a December 31st.
Senator Wilson?
No, I'll defer to Senator Costello.
Senator Costello?
Through the chair, thank you for that. Perhaps it might be good if this bill is going to travel through the process that we have something in writing from the Permanent Fund Dividend Division just to back up what was said in committee. That would be my recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Costello. Other questions? Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did a research report on residency, or on the word resident and what a residency means for fishing licenses, hunting licenses, PFDs. Like, there's literally 30 or 40 different definitions for resident. But for the purpose of the permanent fund dividend in Title 43, it does say an individual who's physically present in the state with an intent to remain indefinitely, and then has those requirements with those dates. And then it talks about if they're not physically present but they intend to return to the state, that kind of thing. So it is pretty clear for the PFD that it's a different type of requirement. I don't know how it works when you talk about fishing licenses, though, for kids. But I'm okay with the resident issue. I think that that's pretty fleshed out.
Senator Wilson?
I guess, you know, and I understand, you know, the issue with the permanent fund. And let's say they come in, you know, they get orders in November and they actually don't come to March. Type of situation, could they just say, well, I was a resident since November? And so I understand that, but I guess the other issue would be other state services and other state benefits that someone could technically try to achieve. And I understand this is, we're talking about a very small percentage of the population base of that, so, you know, I don't have any issues with that. And in terms of you know, Senator Coghill's statement, I in terms of the average count, I mean, the count, I just like to move to an average-based count instead of a date count, and that a whole school district weren't accountable for their population management through the entire year instead of just the first school count, or just have someone on the books and never attend classes. So.
Thank you. Ms. Tuck, would you like to respond to that?
Not so much to respond to that, but just to make a statement through the chair to Senator Coghill. We did discuss the ADMs in the House education, and if it would be of a benefit to you, I can get those and get you what the ADM was discussed there prior to your hearing it in Senate education.
And to the benefit or for the committee's awareness, we actually do have a response from the Permanent Fund Dividend Corporation. And we're going to distribute that now. I do apologize that it was not in the packet. We will make sure and include that now. And essentially the response is indicating that we do not have an issue from their perspective as far as their residency concerns. Senator Coghill, did you have?
Mr. Chairman, I think we should take the offer up from the sponsor to have the information on the ADM brought to you and distributed through the committee. I think that would be a good thing if you'd be so inclined to do that. I'd be glad to be knowledgeable on that issue.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Any other questions? All right. Well, I do appreciate it, Representative Ledoux. Ms. Tuck, thank you very much. I think what we're going to do is we're going to hold this and flesh a couple of these issues out. If you could get us that. Yes, I'm seeing.
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. All right. What we're going to do is we're going to hold this bill. And brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. The next meeting will be held this Thursday, the 20th at 3:30 p.m. We will review four governor appointees to the Alaska Police Standards Council, take up SB 169, License Plates Council on the Arts, and we're going to see if we can't get a couple of these bills back in front of us, as well as SB 167, Aggravating Factor Corrections Officer. Please submit any questions or amendments to the committee by 3 o'clock Wednesday the 19th. The meeting is adjourned at 4:20 p.m.